Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to New Books in Education, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Christina Bosch, one of the hosts on the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Frederick Fauvet about their new book, Handbook of Research on Applying Universal Design for Learning Across Disciplines, Concepts, Case Studies, and Practical Implementation. This book delves into what fans will recognize by the acronym UDL, Universal Design for Learning, a framework that has been hailed for over 3 decades as a revolutionary lens that allows educational environments to shift their efforts away from reactionary individualized remediation and towards inclusive design at the outset. This book offers practical examples of UDL having successfully been embedded in courses within various disciplines and classroom formats, as well as the undergraduate and graduate sectors. Dr. Fauvet, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for the invitation. Happy to be here.
And we are especially excited to have you today because this is an interview that's being conducted with Dr. Kimberly Coy in tandem. Would you like to just say hello?
Hello, and thank you for being here, and thank you for the invitation.
Yeah, thank you all for joining. This makes it more fun. And we're also being, we have in attendance students from Fresno State, woohoo. And so they will be able to ask questions after we've conducted the interview, but I just wanted to give them a shout out and say thank you to all of them for being educators and being interested. All right, so to get this started, Dr. Fauvet, will you tell us a bit about yourself with a focus on your educational journey and your journey to publishing this book, particularly as it came out last year in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Thanks. Yeah, so I would say I consider myself as a UDL researcher, scholar, and practitioner. I came to the area of inclusion from different avenues in my life, as sometimes happens. You don't always see the cohesiveness of your journey till you get to midpoint and you see the threads coming together. So I was actually a lawyer in a previous life, and that gave me the first sort of hat and a sort of legal perspective on equity issues and social justice issues from a purely legal sort of perspective. And then I had a career break there, decided to go back to education. I worked in the area of, so I was in England at the time of what's called social emotional behavior difficulties, which I think in the US is more known as EBD. And I was in that field, both in terms of scholarship and in terms of practice, because I was actually a teacher in a school for students with EBD, and then became a principal of a school really catering to the needs of students with EBD for about 11 years of my career. And then from then on, decided to go into the PhD, and I wanted to continue working while I was doing the PhD, but I wanted to leave the field to have a bit more distance on what I was doing because I was writing about K-12. So I decided to move into post-secondary, and I took on the role of head of accessibility basically at McGill University for 4 years during my PhD. And that was really important for me because I had so up to then been working on inclusion from an ecological perspective, and I'm sure we'll have a chance to talk about that. But that added a sort of layer in terms of disability studies and looking at similar issues, but looking at them from a disability studies lens. And after that, I became faculty. So I've worked 3 years on the University of Prince Edward Island at East, and I've been for 3 years at Royal Roads University at Western BC. I've done both sides of the country, working again mostly in inclusion, but I would say that more and more, I oversee a program at the moment, which is a master's in education leadership and management. So I find that more and more the contemporary questions now is not no longer just how do you achieve inclusion in the classroom, but how do you lead for inclusion. So how do we tackle organizational institutional challenges around creating that culture and creating those provisions? And then right through, there was a thread around universal design for learning, which I'm sure we're going to have a chance to talk about today, which came up in a minute. I think I was using it with students with challenging behaviors without having necessarily the vocabulary for it. And then it's when I got into disability studies that I really had access to the framework itself and a certain discourse that's shared by many other scholars around the world. And now, I continue to use it fairly extensively, but as I'm sure we'll talk about today, I also see its limits, that sometimes we have to also see other frameworks that complement it so that we can go beyond just disability and impairment to consider inclusion from a variety of perspectives. So we may, and I'm sure we'll talk about this today, have to combine it and look at the overlap with other sort of theoretical frameworks.
Fantastic. Thank you for that overview. And I should have mentioned in the beginning, just in this, virtual and audio world, where we're coming in from. So I mentioned that we're here in the Central Valley in California in the States, and you are somewhere in Canada, forgive me.
I'm in BC. I'm in Victoria, so on West Coast BC. So same time zone as you are, but straight north. Yeah, just there.
Fantastic.
By the same latitude as Seattle, yeah.
Great. Thank you for that orientation. And of course, all of us are on unceded Indigenous land. So yes, you mentioned we're going to talk a little bit about UDL. Let's get right into that. You give an introduction to it in the handbook, in the handbook being your recently published book. In the second half of that first chapter, you provide an overview of some of the remaining challenges for research and practice in terms of UDL. We'll get to that. But just to make sure that everybody knows what we're talking about, give us your UDL elevator pitch and help us break down what exactly universal design for learning means.
Definitely. It's actually a lot harder than it appears, because I think if you do a quick Google search of UDL, you get, a few years back, you already had a couple of millions, results right away. There's conflicting views as to what it is. And I'd say I'm not necessarily a purist. I don't necessarily go back to a sort of rigid definition of what it is. I think for me, it makes sense to contextualize it right away by looking at this term inclusion that we have, which really means very different things for very different people. And some of the big threads that appear within the field of inclusion are people who, again, come at it from a legal perspective, from a human rights perspective. Other people come to it from, a sort of biophysiological perspective, certainly when it comes to impairment and disability. Others look at it from either an ecological perspective, et cetera. Some look at it from a philosophical perspective, simply saying, it's something we should do, that the classroom should be a microcosm for the society. That's the Salamanca statement, was often known as the grounding for that philosophical approach. So I think the result is that we can often actually be talking at cross purposes and not talking about the same thing at all. So within this term of inclusion, that's where I would contextualize UDL and saying it's probably, for me, the only approach which moves away irretrievably from a deficit model approach, because it takes the focus away from any student who sees as exceptional and places the focus instead on the designer of the learning experience. So saying really there's no such thing as exceptionality, we should take it for granted, it's there, it's a given, it's granted, it's in all of our classroom. It's really up to us to be designing inclusively. So I think it's that big shift. And I tend to say it translates the social model of disability in saying really that, disability is not in the individual, but it's in the interaction of the individual with the context, with the environment. So I think UDL is, out of all the models that we have, individualized learning, differentiation, et cetera, I think it's the only model that has that characteristic of saying from the get-go, it's not about the learner. It's not about stressing the exceptionality of the learner. It's actually about looking at the design of the learning experience. And that places the focus right back on us as educators, not on the students having to fit in or having to demonstrate or anything, or having to, to self-identify as having a need. So that would be the essence of it. And as this only model within the world of inclusion that does this, again, as I said, it translates, in my eyes, it translates the social model of disability, saying that really impairment and disability are not so much an inherent quality of the individual, but it's a relational sort of interactional experience between individual embodiment And I think there's about 21 of 23 of you here. If we had the time, we would go through and each of you would say that there's something that makes you exceptional. There's an embodiment that you have which is specific to you that is not common to all other people. But the lucky ones of us are in a situation where that embodiment doesn't clash with the expectations of the environment, the design expectations of the environment, or the design expectation of the classroom. So that's what UDL does. It really puts the spotlight back on the educator to saying, considering diversity in all of our classrooms, what can you do to design inclusively so that students will not have an experience of disability in their everyday experiences within the classroom? Does that satisfy you in terms of overall big umbrella?
That was wonderful. And I want to just highlight a couple of things that you mentioned too, that I think are useful for listeners who may be tuning in from all over. One is that I feel like there's an implicit idea of the teacher as a designer and not just a sort of sage on the stage, right? And that might be interesting for folks who are new to the profession or getting into it, because there's also increasingly this overlap between the idea of designing learning experiences in classrooms in brick and mortar schools, but also, especially in the wake of the pandemic, online for educational technology, et cetera. So I wanted to lift that up, and you mentioned the word design a lot, and obviously universal design for learning, but as you say, puts the spotlight sort of back on the teacher, and also on the teacher as in this other sort of role as more of a designer of an environment. And you mentioned models. So I also just wanted to highlight for folks that, you know, in the States and in California, we have general ed versus special ed model. This is a typical model in many countries. Every state in the US may have a slightly different twist on that, as California does. Similar with countries, right? Different approaches to sort of classifying students according to disability type. And earlier you had mentioned disability studies in your intro. That's a very different approach to understanding disability than we get in the special ed, general ed dichotomy. So just, you know, to sort of make sure that we're all talking about the same thing. And you also briefly mentioned, though you've alluded to it a bunch, the social model of disability. Would you just bring us all on board to of like what that means?
Absolutely. So the social model of disability is a model that's actually been around for quite a few decades. The difficulty with the social model is that people often not do it from an academic perspective, but often find it very difficult to embrace it and adopt it in everyday situation. But really, it's again saying that disability is not an inherent characteristic of an individual or an inherent label of the individual, but that it is a perception, an experience that is created in a sort of lack of fit or friction between an individual embodiment and an environment or an experience or a service or product that has not been designed inclusively enough to allow seamless use and seamless experience. So it is a social construct in the sense of saying, you know, it's especially when we look at special ed, as you said, which can be very divisive. I'm sure we'll come back on that today. On one hand, it comes from a human rights perspective, saying, you know, we have to look at the equity of these students, but at the same time, it also categorizes and labels them as being exceptional, different than the norm, different than the mainstream classroom. A social model of disability approach is going to be very different in the sense of saying that any of us or any student is able to experience a feeling of disability if they are placed in an environment that is not designed to integrate and adapt to their embodiment and their needs and their objectives and their wants. And so it is going to be a really revolutionary concept for teachers. I find it's a pity that often we don't talk about the social model enough in pre-service teaching, because I find in in-service teaching, often teachers have a eureka moment because they've never really thought about that. You know, we're so entrenched in coding and labeling because of funding. Obviously, we work within a social historical context where that those categories are necessary because it gives us access to funding. But at the same time, that sort of entrenches us in a system that perpetuates this labeling, and in a way, I'll quickly say stigmatization as well, because once you are identified as being different, identified as being exceptional, it's going to be very different to prevent discrimination and prevent stigmatization, and particularly prevent loss of social capital in the classroom. Because if you're different, you don't interact with others in the same way. Often you don't have the same opportunities, and therefore often you lose social capital. You lose opportunities that your peers have because they are not seen as different. They are not seen as exceptional.
So you said you lose social, what was the word you used?
Social model of disability?
Did you say social capital?
Social capital, yeah. So social capital being this notion that schools don't just are not just a place of acquisition of competencies and skills, but they are also a forum where people develop social capital. So social capital in a nutshell, and there are varying definitions of social capital, is the notion that when we're in environments such as schools, we form networks, and that the width and the richness of these networks are a real value. That's why it's a capital. It's a real asset once we leave school that enables us to integrate society, function adequately, have access to opportunities, whether social or work. And really, it's, if you think about it, it's not such a surprise. You know, if people have been paying private tuition in private schools for so long, I don't think parents necessarily have the mythical idea that teaching is so different there that it's worth $40,000. But they very well know that it gives you access to contacts and opportunities that you may not have in another environment. And that's really already an acknowledgement of social capital. But I think schools are coming to realize that it's just as important really as the acquisition of competencies, and that we are also designing environments where students can be supported as they form social capital and develop social capital, or we can be the architects of schools where students are not able to do that. So that's again where UDL comes in. And that's why that notion of inclusion in an authentic way, where everyone is in a whole class approach and strategies are used indiscriminately for everyone in the classroom, is going to be very important, because that's going to give the students access to full opportunities for social capital development.
Yeah, along those lines, I want to also just sort of pause and lift up that there's a difference too, right, between identities that you claim and you bring into a learning space, which could include disability identity or identities. There's a difference between that and then having that imposed on you, right, through a system or a different group, right, that you don't necessarily share that membership with. And I think that is maybe a good segue too, and some of the stuff you were just mentioning about social capital, because a lot of times the social capital that we get is coming from or is contingent on the groups that we're members of, right? That determines too, like what's valued and whatnot. So could you talk a little bit about, I know there's some of this in your initial chapter in the book on implementing UDL beyond disability, particularly since in the Central Valley, there's rich, rich diversity in terms of linguistic backgrounds, cultural backgrounds, nationalities, ethnicities, races, et cetera. I feel like that's a good segue to get into what you sort of mean by that implementation of UDL beyond disability.
Absolutely. And I think that section in my chapter is a sort of self-reflective and self-critical look, because I think as UDL advocates, even though for a long time now, I think all UDL advocates have been saying it's not just about disability, it's not just about impairment, we are still very much always bringing this up in a context of special ed, more specifically a context of impairment and disability. So I think that's the next frontier, is how do we break away from that? How do we push UDL to be useful in a wider context? And more generally, how does the inclusion discourse do that as well, right? Move away from just the notion of impairment and disability in classroom, but look at beyond that and establishing provisions that work for the broad diversity of students in our classroom. It is both easy and difficult, because I think if you look at the three UDL principles broadly, I think there's ample room there to apply that to students of wide diversity generally. An exercise I tend to do with my master's students, we say, okay, how can you use the three UDL principles to create inclusive provisions for students from LGBTQ2S+ communities? And we do that as an exercise. And there's always a stall, but what do you mean? Why would we use UDL? And then when you use this design thinking, you realize that design thinking works for whatever aspect of diversity really you're looking at. So I think the problem is not necessarily the framework itself, but it's the sort of inherent resistance that we build, that we always take the discourse back to, okay, it's about disability and it's about impairment. So there's really a change of mindset which is required. And I think that's difficult, because again, because of the pervasive sort of special ed sort of labels and disciplines, et cetera, we are always pushed back to looking at inclusion in a very narrow way, looking just at impairment and disability, and especially now with a heavy focus on cognitive exceptionality, et cetera. And really, we should start looking at it much more broadly. So obviously, I think race is the first thing that comes to mind. And it, and there's been a lot of discourse about, for example, how to you know, widen the UDL implementation to include inclusion for racialized students. But I think we also have to look at second language learners, culturally diverse learners. For us, certainly in Canada, it's part of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission objectives. How do we also create inclusive provisions for Indigenous students? So all of these areas really are areas where UDL is going to be just as important. But we need the will to be wanting to put the focus on the use of UDL within these environments. And that's what needs to change. It's really a change in mindset and getting teachers to be more comfortable pushing that reflection beyond just the usual sort of categories of you know, of disability and impairment that they encounter in the classroom. Now, obviously, we've got to look at this from a legal perspective as well. There's in both Canada and in the US, there's very strong legal protections for individuals with you know, disability, and that has been the momentum that has ensured that we look at inclusion, you know, ferociously from that perspective. But I mean, race is also protected, you know, cultural diversity is also legally protected. So I think now we need to look at, you know, these other environments too, even if the teeth of the legislation are not as strong, but seeing that these are also objectives that we need to incorporate in our vision of inclusion.
That's beautiful. Thank you. And that, of course, also reminds me of disability justice and the critique, right, that relying on the legal system to ensure equitable access and participation in education or in society and social systems privileges those who are most able to sort of maneuver and benefit from the legal system, which is oftentimes going to already be folks who have the most sort of privilege within the society. So with that in mind, I'd love to also just sort of touch on, you have some stuff on UDL and field education, which is what everyone here is doing. So I'm happy to open the door to some critiques, especially once we're, you know, doing Q&A at the end. But tell us a little bit about what that could mean, what it usually does mean, UDL and field education.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, we have a chapter that looks at field placements for social work students, and then another chapter that looks at a field education for health students. And I think we could definitely, you know, there was no chapter sort of contributed about field education for pre-service teachers, but that would be very much the same premise and the same sort of challenges. I think we've done very well in the last 10 years in higher ed at developing awareness around universal design for learning and inclusion more generally. And we are getting better at having that reflective lens on our courses and our services and at looking at, you know, how hospitable and how inclusive they are. But often we become very guarded as soon as there's a field component. Now, what I've seen in my experience, particularly when I worked at McGill, is we often find ourselves as program coordinator, et cetera, working with field coordinators, that we often feel that we have a gatekeeping role, that we should not disrupt the relationship that we have with those field coordinators, and therefore we shouldn't push the envelope. We shouldn't really be challenging, you know, what is in a changing social context, what should be reasonable in terms of inclusive practices, what should we do about changing, you know, mindsets, et cetera, in the field. And when I've talked to coordinators, often, I mean, you can understand where they come from. Those relationships are often very difficult to build. They are tenuous. You almost feel grateful that, yes, that this field placement is willing to take your students on for this and that and these many students. So we don't want to disrupt that. But I think at the same time, I've been in practice when I was head of accessibility at McGill in many situations where you realize that in that effort to be gatekeepers of standards that are external to us, we become very defensive. I'll give you an example. At one point, I worked with a PTOT department, physical occupational therapy, and they have a fourth-year clinical placement. So, you know, 3 years of academic classroom training, and then they go into the field for repeated sort of field placement in fourth year. And what we're seeing a lot of students with, accommodations, et cetera, who had done very well academically, but were being put into field placements and failing quite dramatically in their fourth year, which was terrible because that meant that they would not be able to graduate, et cetera. And I remember we were called in onto one of these incidents, and we were actually, there was an opportunity for us to talk to the field coordinator directly. And the problem with these students is the students who had always had access to technology, assistive technology in their device, speech to text, et cetera. And suddenly they had to write patient notes in 5 minutes between patients with a pen and a piece of paper. And that's where they were failing on. That suddenly they could not, they had never been asked in the last 9-10 years to write with a pen on a piece of paper in very limited time between patients. And they were being failed on their ability to take patient notes. So when we as accessibility services talked to field placement, we said, well, would they be able to access technology? Could you give them an iPad? Could you give them something on which they could actually type the patient notes? And the reaction was from the entire governing body, we should actually be doing this for everyone. This was in Quebec. We should actually be doing this for everyone. And so that conversation led to actually a UDL solution where every single person doing a practicum was offered the possibility of having a tablet or a device or a handheld device instead. And I think you see, this shows how often the field environment knows that it's changing organically. This is a change society needs, things need to happen. But I think one of the problems is that often the coordinators in the universities can be very, very rigid, very scared of trying to trigger this conversation. So that's one aspect of this. I think it's also interesting for us because it confronts us with the fact that society standards are changing. UBC a few years back was confronted with a lawsuit from a resident, medical resident who is visually impaired, significantly visually impaired, really clinically blind, who wants to become a surgeon and took the case to the Supreme Court. And UBC had to step back and say there was nothing actually stopping this person from becoming a surgeon. Now, I think that there are issues that will arise from this because, you're not necessarily going to be able to have a full license if you are, significantly visually impaired. But I think it's led to, again, in Canada, to the Royal College of Surgeons starting conversation about saying, well, maybe we should rethink licensing. Maybe licensing, instead of being a broad, you are a surgeon to be, a general physician, and it's fine to be visually impaired and be a general physician. It's fine to be a psychiatrist and be visually impaired. So some nuance there is starting to be created in these organizations, these external bodies. And I think we with UDL have a great impact. There's a great impact that we can have in those conversations. So it's not just about the learning space, not just about academia or schools, but I think it's the time where we need to also use UDL as a discourse with these industry partners, field partners, to actually create a continuum. And because that's the principle of UDL really, is that even as kids transfer from elementary school to secondary, to primary secondary and to post-secondary, they are no longer confronted with systems that are not cohesive and are contradictory and use different interventions. They can actually progress right through with a system that makes sense for them. And from their eyes is creates a continuum. So I think now the continuum must be extended into the workplace as well. And that's where field education, definitely creates opportunities, I think, to discuss inclusion, but most specifically UDL as well.
I was also thinking while you were talking about partnerships from universities and school districts, at Fresno State, we're really focusing more toward a residency model now, but some of our partners are in different places. And then, we're educating our own students to look for UDL or to use it, and then they're not giving opportunities. Do you have those frictions as well?
We have those frictions. And I think Christine's going to ask me a question later on in the chapter that I've offered, where I talk about the contradictions of even graduate students in inclusion in Canada, who sometimes do not see UDL principles model. So they could ironically be on a course on UDL without seeing the UDL principles model. And I think that creates a huge amount of frictions and questioning for students in the sense of, I'm supposed to be learning this, I'm supposed to be doing this, but it's not being done in the interactions that I have in my graduate education. I think that can be seen in both pre-service teaching where, UDL, and I know about, I can only talk about Canada, but in Canada, it's starting to pop up as a course content, but it's certainly not again being modeled in terms of practices. There's a, I mean, we have to look at this from a socioeconomic perspective as well and political perspective. There's a huge pressure in Canada to reduce the length of you know, BEd qualification. So a lot of campuses now try and squeeze 3 years into one, which means that often you can have a day that lasts from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, right? And you do this for 12 months. There's only so much you can do in terms of modeling practices where you are prioritizing speed and, you know, speed and quick delivery. So I think there's a dual pressure there that we want to model more and more, but we also do it in a context where it's harder and harder to be modeling this because simply of time pressures and, you know, external constraints. So we see this in pre-service teaching, we see this in graduate education. And I think even in in-service training, so often, you know, I'm called in to come in and do consultancy gigs in schools for in-service teachers. I think, again, we have to question the in-service sort of, you know, training model, because often it's very little time. We're very focused on, you know, this represents a lot of subbing, or we just have one PD day and everything gets needs to be done in one PD day. But very quickly with UDL, I find that, yeah, you can give a good keynote, you can do a little workshop, but people will often say right away, but I want to try this out. I'm going to have questions. I want to experiment. I want to implement it. I want to come back to you and discuss those questions. And often we don't have the time, again, simply in terms of constraints. So, yeah, I think we're doing pretty poorly in education in terms of modeling the values that we expect our students to have as they enter the workplace in terms of UDL and certainly inclusion.
I like the way you say that, modeling the values, but puts it in a nice light.
Thanks.
Related to that, I want to just touch on something else that you talk about early in the book, which has to do with global south and global north dynamics. And speaking of sort of like modeling values, right? Like the UDL framework comes out of what we might think of as the global north, usually referring to North America, really Western Europe usually, right? So pretty narrow focus, but these are terms that are contested, right? The language around how we talk about geopolitical centers of power has shifted over time from things like the developing world, first world. So just the point is that UDL really sort of emerges out of the US in particular and has had worldwide impact. Inclusion really also sort of comes out of the Scandinavian countries, UK, as well as the US. In what ways, can you talk a little bit about in what ways that sort of replicates the imperialism of the global north to the global south, and in what ways UDL maybe has yet to really draw on knowledge and wisdoms from outside of these regions?
Thanks. So yeah, I would divide this in three parts, my answer to you. So the first one is, I think as you know, any tradition, a theoretical tradition has origins, and this one happens to be North America, really, that's where it took birth. But I think we've now reached a level nearly three decades on where wherever something is born, you have to question the way it's being shared and spread and enables other communities to empower themselves. I'm not seeing an enormous amount of that happening within the UDL sort of body of scholars. And it's something that is difficult. I know, you know, for having been a keynote, that I've tried to organize a Pan-Canadian conference on UDL, and we've had one in 2015, 2017, 2019. At the 2019, I certainly, you know, did a large call with our Indigenous scholars saying, you know, this is a conference for you and you should be part of this. And we want you to be engaged in that discourse. But we didn't manage to get Indigenous scholar attendance. And I think it's because it is a long process and a long set of patterns to break, right? Once you're in that position where it's the discourse of the colonizer or the discourse of the you know, developing world or global north, it's very hard to break. So I think we have a global responsibility to just keep opening those doors and keep having that questioning. Every time you edit a book, even if it's not successful, to think, I have a duty here to make sure that there are other voices that are included in this book. Every time you do a collaboration in writing, every time you do a workshop, to try and see if anyone is available. And it's not going to happen at once. It's going to take you know, several years, maybe decades, but it is a global responsibility to keep calling and inviting and creating hospitable environment for Indigenous scholars, Global South scholars, anyone really, you know, you've spent some time in Latin America, and I find that even that is a body of scholars that is not necessarily always invited into the discourse simply because they write in Spanish, and we have great divide there between the English-speaking UDL discourse and you know, Spanish speakers. So really an effort to be made and a collective responsibility. I think we also have to look at the fact that any scholarship comes out of a publishing process, which is also a publishing machine, I would say. You know, there's some neoliberal, you know, undertones to that. Papers don't just appear, they are published by publishers. We have processes. Those processes, we know them to be heavily biased towards global north, you know, writers in because of theory, because the double blind process often calls on people who have the same background as you, judging whether you're using the theoretical frameworks they're used to, using the vocabulary they're used to. And if that's the case, you pass the double blind review. It's a lot harder for someone who works from outside these networks to successfully go through the double blind. So it's not as objective as we make it to be. So the result is that there are actually now growing voices from India, and for the sub-Indian continent generally, from sub-Saharan Africa, from Latin America, who are getting published locally, but are finding it really hard to break into the wider sort of you know, networks and the wider sort of publishing house and books, etc. So I think there we have a collective duty as well to put pressure on, you know, on our collaborators and our publishers and the people we work with to say, you know, it's time for us to change that in a very intentional way to make sure that we have that representation. The last point is that I think we have to realize that because, and that's where the colonizing view, I think, comes in. We all do it. I do it as well sometimes, to assume that because we've gone through this process of industrialization and development, everyone is going to follow historically the same process. So you assume that a country which is arriving at, you know, at accessibility legislation, education and inclusion legislation 30 years after us is going to follow linearly the same process that we've had. Well, we've made a lot of mistakes in that process. And I would say that we're not shining examples at the moment of how well it's gone and how successful it is. And we are seeing people in the global south or the developing countries generally saying, hang on, we want to get to where you are in inclusive education, but we don't want to make the mistakes you've made along the way. So could you actually show us the shortcuts so we can get there without repeating 30 years of, you know, of twists and turns? So I've done quite a bit of work in India, for example, and I'm involved in an inclusive network of scholars in India. And it's really interesting because when you go out there, that's the questions that you get. Like, we don't want to approach this from a purely sort of legal avenue and find ourselves in 20 years' time saying it's not working in the field. What can we do to create authentic inclusion in the classroom from the get-go and go to something that looks like UDL without having to go to something like IEPs and those adaptations that along the way. So I think there's some really great discussions to have. And I think also we've got to realize that that context isn't our context in terms of accessibility to technology, which we take for granted, to things like, you know, when I go to India, I find it really sobering that my colleagues will say, Yeah, we understand everything you're saying in this workshop, but we've got a class of 120 students. Does that work in a class of 120 students, right? Looking at different variables altogether and making sure that discourse that we are, you know, propagating and perpetuating actually makes sense in these contexts. Because it's one thing in your class of 20 to say, oh, this is how I do UDL, but could you do it in the class 120? And can you do it without technology, right? And that's where it becomes interesting. That's where we need to start engaging in these important questions in terms of you know, bringing in these voices into the UDL discourse.
Frederick, that was such a rich response, and I wish I could remember how to do like a tripartite response like that in my head. But one thing I think UDL models for folks is that organizing things in threes is helpful. So just looking at the time, you know, I wanted to maybe just throw a little bit of a curveball and just ask you, there's so much in this book. It's rich. It's huge. What, maybe before we start wrapping up, do you want to highlight that perhaps we haven't touched on yet that's in there?
So it is a huge book. So I think we have 23 chapters and 30-odd you know, contributors. I think what we tried to do with this was to show the complexity and the diversity of implementation itself. And I think one mistake, which maybe we do in higher ed at the moment, but we probably do in the K-12 sector too, is that we talk about, you know, one size does not fit all in terms of pedagogy. But then we look at UDL and we assume that one size fits all in terms of implementation. And I think that's also where we're wrong, right? UDL implementation can look very different depending on your context, your community, the history of your institution, the previous organizational trends and mindset. So it can end up looking very different. But I think that's the richness of it, because people don't really want a top-down model where it's just checklists and you're going, I'm going through this and I land at the same result. UDL is actually a principle that leads you to a self-reflection on practice, that lands on your practice, a self-reflection on practice about how to move. If UDL is a spectrum, how to move more towards a richer UDL recipe than where you are now. So everyone will land in a different place, and that's totally normal. As long as that reflection makes sense and the process that led you to those design choices makes sense, that result probably makes sense in terms of the design solutions because of the context that you're in. So I think that's what this book was trying to show, that there's a multiplicity, a complexity of solutions, but that's fine, and that's totally fine. But it's that journey that's important. And that journey, once you're engaged with it, doesn't stop, right? You will continue to reflect on inclusive design and come to build a toolbox that in a few years you'll have even more design solutions, and you will continue that and get more feedback from your students and be able to engage further. So that's one important aspect. The other aspect is, it's structured in a way that looks at, well, there's my introductory, overview, but then it looks at really just moving away from accommodations. Then it talks about implementing UDL in new environment. And I think that's important for us too in K-12, because you are going to meet people out there who say, but how do I do UDL in an arts class? How do I do UDL in a phys ed classroom? How do I do UDL in a language lab? And that's the exciting part of the moment, is they're not necessarily solutions, but there's a hopeful development of a rich scholarship there, that we widen that envelope. It's not just about the humanities class or the English class or the math class. There's more environments there that need to be explored where UDL can lead to interesting design solutions. And then towards the end, there's also areas for improvements. Well, I think that's very important for us in K-12 too. There are lots of reasons why we have to keep being self-critical about the way we implement UDL. And as we discussed today, one of those immediate suggestions is that we have to go beyond disability and look at race, look at sexual and gender identity, look at culture and language, second language speakers, and to widen those design reflexes that we built, widen them to that full clientele as a habit, right? So that we don't even think about it, we do it systematically. And then the very end, the last two chapters are really where a look on the post-secondary sector. But I think you had a question that you were going to bring up, Christina, about Sam Johnson's sort of chapter, where she talks about affordability of the post-secondary sector. And I think that leads us to an important thing too, an important aspect, even in K-12, is I think so far we've looked at UDL simply being a pedagogical dimension, a pedagogical flavor within the classroom. But we've got to think of the journey of these students getting to that classroom. And there's an awful lot of barriers there too. And if UDL is about analyzing from a barriers perspective, what are the hurdles that are created in the journey of the students, and then removing these barriers through design thinking, then we automatically have to think as well, first of all, of school cultures, hidden curriculum, issues around costs, and affordability, even in K-12, to make sure that, not only are we doing inclusive practices in the classroom, but the journey that leads the students to the schools and to those classrooms are also barrier-free, that we actually create, a term that I see a lot of my Canadian colleagues talk about is hospitable environment, right? Well, how are you being hospitable? Well, certainly affordability and removing, financial barriers, for example, is a huge area of the barriers. And here it leads us to, in K-12, we're very quick sometimes say, well, in public education, we don't have the cost element, but I think that as well has to be demystified. If you're interested in this, look at the concept of school stratification. Schools are now led into an environment where they have to compete just like private schools, even if they're public. Compete for fun, compete for clients, because they are clients. Parents vote with their feet. They buy a house or they buy accommodation in an area where they want to school their kids. So there's a huge amount of buying and selling. There's a huge mercantilization of access to secondary education. And that's going to be creating hurdles for our students as well. So we have automatically to engage with those, with those issues as well. Hidden curriculum, when you look at, for example, second language learners, immigrant learners, yes, you may have access to that school, but how hospitable, how welcoming is it going to be if you don't have the extra cash to do, the extracurricular trip that happens on that week, or you can't go on that visit because your parents can't afford the simple fee that you need to pay to be able to have access to something, right? So I think even in K-12, that's a huge element of the reflection that we need to have. And I'm glad Sam wrote that chapter, because I think we don't talk about that enough, that it's social justice starts in the wallet, right? If you don't have access to things, even if the teaching is superbly inclusive once you're there, you can't have access to that space or that opportunity. Well, that's not an inclusive environment.
Thank you so much I really like ending on that note. I think you had mentioned earlier something about how UDL now really leads us to some political considerations and the material ones, and thinking of journeys to school, affordability of school, et cetera, really, really drive that point home. Thank you so much for that and for an excellent summary. I guess to really wrap up and conclude, I'd love to know if you're able to share, what are you currently working on next, or what's your next project, or what has you excited right now?
So I'm currently, I've got a call out for chapters for a second book, which is actually looking at UDL case studies and implementation from teachers' voices and administrators' voices in the K-12 sector, because after this one, we felt the importance of also, having a call for K-12 teachers. It is hard because a lot of teachers can feel that it's very daunting to write a chapter and gain an academic voice. So I think there's a lot of support required, and that's what I've offered, to try and be really empowering and to be available and to do a lot of editorial support for chapters. Yes, please, if you it's all the week still and until the weekend, a quick little proposal, and then we'll sort of talk to you about how to get it there. But I think it's really important. I think it's really, really urgent, because there's a lot of really interesting things happening around UDL in both North America, in North America, Canada, and the US. But a lot of these stories go unreported and undocumented. And unfortunately, that means that every other school board, every other school has to reinvent the wheel in some way. And we are at that level where we should not be reinventing the wheel. We should be sharing these practices and these experiences and documenting them so that other people can borrow and share. That's the spirit of UDL as well, that you are engage in that inclusive design thinking, and you don't have to always go back to square one. You can start where other people have left off and then continue to build on that collective discourse that's out there. So hopefully we'll see more and more of these sort of teacher narratives that tell us exactly what it's like. And there's some significant hurdles too, when you look at implementing UDL in schools. We see a lot of initial curiosity and momentum, but sustaining that is hard. So there's some interesting narratives that need to be told about when you succeed in creating a sustainable interest. How do you do that, and how do you connect with leadership, et cetera, and create a renewed culture that perpetuates itself with regards to UDL?
Thank you so much. I look forward to hearing, writing, reading all the stories that will be in this next book. And thank you so much for taking the time tonight to share with us what makes UDL and what makes your book an important resource for folks. So thanks again.
It's been a pleasure.